Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available at abletrust.org or 850-224-4493. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
A review finds Florida's educational standards assessment valid, but that's not stopping criticism of the exam.
Our students didn't go to school in Utah. Our students went to school here in Florida, where they were taught based on Florida standards, which were approved by the Florida legislature.
Also this week, a confusing three-way battle is heating up over the future of solar power in Florida. If voters get to settle it next year, they'll probably feel like they're groping in the dark.
From a context of consumer protection, we're saying there has to be some regulatory oversight.
We'll also hear about a new effort to solve the state's unsolved murders and get an update on how a Florida man hasn't let a heart transplant slow down his creative juices. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Before we kick off tonight's show, here's some late breaking news from the Florida Capitol. Technically, the building to the immediate west of the Florida Capitol. The Florida Supreme Court this afternoon sent the state's battle about congressional redistricting back to a lower court after lawmakers couldn't agree on a plan during a special session last month. After holding a hearing, Leon County Circuit Judge Terry Lewis will consider House and Senate proposals and recommend a map to the Supreme Court. We'll take a more comprehensive look at this and what it all means in the weeks to come. Florida lawmakers will meet later this month to go over a report that is raising more questions than answers about the state's new standardized tests. Len Hatter reports teachers and local superintendents aren't buying the results of the study, which found the Florida standards assessment valid.
A report commissioned by the legislature to review the Florida standards assessment has found the test can be used for teacher evaluations and school grades, but it should not be the only determinant for graduation and promotions. The FSA got off to a rough start this year. Technical glitches plagued the administration of the exam, and critics say the state rushed to roll it out. Now Leon County Superintendent Jackie Pons is promising his teachers won't be punished for poor student performance.
Let's not affect our teachers' evaluations in a negative way because of an assessment that we know that was given was not reliable.
But Florida Education Commissioner Pam Stewart says the state will use the test to evaluate teachers and issue school grades.
And we are pleased with this information and are using it right now to try to move forward for this 15-16 year.
Florida had been slated to use a different test, but furor over the Common Core tanked that. The state backed out of a testing consortium and hired an outside vendor to create the Florida Standards Assessment. But the review found too many of the test questions don't fit Florida standards. Many of those questions have their roots in Utah. Democratic Senator Bill Montford.
Yes, our students didn't go to school in Utah. Our students went to school here in Florida, where they were taught based on Florida standards, which were approved by the Florida legislature.
Montford heads the Florida Association of District School Superintendents, and he says the results of the exam should not be used to grade teachers and schools.
It's not fine for students. It's not fine for teachers. It's not fine for parents and superintendents.
Montford is also concerned with part of the review that found many of the items students were tested on didn't match state standards. In the 10th grade English language arts exam, a third of the questions were either partially matched or didn't match any of Florida's standards. And that's a problem for high school principal Shelley Bell, who wonders if that's what caused some students to not pass the test.
If the state would pull out the partial standard match and the no standard match out of the assessment, say, okay, these are not valid questions, and let's just grade the kids on what they were, the standards that were matched. I'd be really curious to know, because I guarantee that the passing rate for kids would go up significantly.
Retakes are slated to start in October, and school administrators are skeptical whether that leaves enough time for the test to be revised. Meanwhile, Republican Senator John Legge has issued a warning to superintendents like Leon's Jackie Pons, who may be considering ignoring the test results when they do teacher evaluations.
I read some of Superintendent Pons' statements. I think he's jumping the gun a little bit. He's leaving without looking, without reading the nuances of the report. And I would caution him not to willfully violate the law and put the funding of Leon County in jeopardy.
Legge says he, too, is concerned about the results of the test review, but he believes there are more nuances in the report that need consideration, and he plans to take it up in a September 17th committee hearing.
We need to take those recommendations, and we need to move forward to ensure that our students are not adversely impacted, but yet we still have accountability. It's critically important that we have accountability.
Meanwhile, state education leaders and teachers are meeting to set the passing levels for the exam and crunch numbers that will eventually result in grades for schools and evaluations of teachers. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Solar power has always been popular in the Sunshine State, and as the costs come down, interest in the clean energy alternative is heating up, and so is the political battle for control of the market, as we hear from Jim Ash.
Imagine you go into the voting booth to decide the future of solar power in Florida. This is mostly the information you would have to go on for three proposed constitutional amendments. First, Floridians for Solar Choice.
This is not big business. This is mom and pop. This is the young couple. This is the retired couple. This is people who live in their own home for the last 30 years and who want a better style of living. They need a choice. And the only way for them to have that choice is for us to change the laws in Florida.
Next, consumers for smart solar.
Most of us agree, solar energy is an important part of Florida's future. And in 2016, Florida voters might even find two solar amendments on their ballot. But be warned, there are some big differences between these two ideas.
Finally, the latest proposal by Republican Senator Jeff Brandis of Sarasota.
Solar installations being taxed on commercial properties as part of the ad valorem tax, so the property value of that facility. And then many properties today don't want to buy the systems, they simply want to lease them, and so we would get rid of the intangibles tax on that leased property.
Here's what it means. Brandis is filing a joint resolution that would allow companies to install solar panels on consumers' roofs without paying taxes on the equipment, and your property taxes wouldn't go up because your solar house is worth more. California-based Solar City, one of the largest solar companies in the nation, says it avoids the Sunshine State because of those taxes. Brandis says he talked to solar companies when he wrote the legislation.
I think the next 10 or 15 years for Florida, you're going to see a substantial shift to solar, and we need to begin to align our laws in preparation for that shift.
Floridians for Solar Choice wants to strip away an even bigger layer of government. Its plan lets solar companies sell small amounts of power, about enough for a single Walmart, without regulators setting the price or defining territories. Picture a landlord installing solar panels and selling the electricity to tenants. Although Solar Choice could end up on the same ballot with the Brandis proposal, the philosophies match, says Floridians for Solar Choice organizer Stephen Smith. He stresses that his group has not taken a formal stance.
We would welcome that because, again, I think anything that actually encourages the market is an appropriate thing.
Finally, there's Consumers for Smart Solar. Smart Solar mainly addresses what its organizers claim would be problems caused by rival Solar Choice. It protects non-solar customers from having to subsidize backup power for solar customers. It also requires regulators to protect consumer rights. That's crucial, says Smart Solar organizer Matthew Carter, a former utility regulator.
Fundamentally, here's what we're seeing. From a context of consumer protection, we're saying there has to be some regulatory oversight. And the way that I read their language, there will be a constitutional exemption from regulation.
Critics point out Smart Solar's proposal would change little, and they claim it asks voters to fix problems that don't or wouldn't exist. The same big utilities backing Smart Solar are asking the Florida Supreme Court to knock rival Solar Choice off the ballot. Utilities argue Solar Choice would wipe out consumer protections. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash. We'll be right back.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a Jacksonville senator says he's coming after the killers responsible for Florida's cold cases.
Let's go after these bad guys. Let's let them know that we are still looking for them. They're not off the hook.
State Fish and Wildlife officials are pushing bear-proof trash cans to discourage the animals from thinking about your home as a place for dinner.
We think it's gross. A bear is like an all-you-can-eat smorgasbord.
And this week, we'll check in with Jamal Davis, a young man who was waiting on a heart transplant when we first heard from him back in May.
I got the chance to go to the beach, get in the water. So it was like the first time I've been in like water for 8 years.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by CGI, a partner to government and industry delivering built-for-government information technology solutions for nearly 40 years. CGI, committed to providing IT results Florida can count on. Details on the web at cgi.com.
The state of Florida needs to do more to help police catch killers. That's the idea behind a Northeast Florida senator's bill. Jacksonville Republican Aaron Bean wants to create a task force to re-examine policies and procedures for dealing with unsolved murders. Lindsay Kilbride with member station WJCT in Jacksonville has more.
Barry Brooks Jr. was 19 when he was killed.
He was our go-getter. I would say if you did not know BJ at the beginning of an event, you knew him at the end of an event because he was the one that stood out.
BJ's mom, Margie Brooks, remembers 2007. Her son was a lifeguard, dance instructor, worked in after-school programs.
Here he is. What he's got his students. He's teaching them how to break dance on top of their heads.
That looks painful.
It does.
She's looking through a huge photo album, and picture after picture, BJ has the biggest smile.
And some of his students, and this was 08, but that's minus him because he was killed.
BJ was murdered in Jacksonville on the evening of November 19th, 2007. His death is one of around 1,300 unsolved murders in the city. That's roughly the same number the entire state of Colorado has. BJ Brooks was outside at a friend's apartment when two guys robbed him, stole his cross necklace, and shot him.
They said he bled to death. They couldn't stop the bleeding.
His mom and dad pulled up at the hospital at the same time as BJ's ambulance.
And sometimes I still think I should have just yelled out one last time, you know, BJ, I love you. Mommy and Daddy are here.
You know, you don't believe it. Yeah. You want to think that they had the wrong person.
BJ's dad, Barry Brooks, says investigators seemed confident at first, told them they had DNA evidence that they were going to find these guys.
Then you realize that they don't have anything to go on. And before you know it, they call on you and they telling you that they can't pursue it no more. They can't spend the man hours. And
today, BJ's case is suspended. That means there aren't any more leads to go on. So investigators have to just wait. Wait for someone to come forward with new information. Ryan Backman knows this feeling. His father was killed in Jacksonville in 2009, and his case is suspended too.
They feel like nobody cares.
Backman started an organization called Project Cold Case to advocate for families like the Brookses.
I want to be that bridge between a frustrated family and a detective that I know is doing their best.
Backman is also working on making a statewide database of the cases, something that doesn't exist anywhere else. And he's teamed up with Jacksonville Republican Senator Aaron Bean on legislation. Bean's bill would create a task force to help standardize cold case investigation procedures across local law enforcement agencies.
Let's step back and let law enforcement define what a cold case is, what information should be put out there to the public, and a system of how it will naturally progress when a case goes cold.
The task force would be made up of 19 people, including sheriffs, police chiefs, and victims' families.
The mission is to bring hope to families who've lost a loved one. You know, there's 15,000 plus murders that are unsolved in the state of Florida since 1990. Let's go after these bad guys. Let's let them know that we are still looking for them. They're not off the hook.
On Sunday afternoon, it's raining on Jacksonville's west side. It's been almost 8 years since B.J. Brooks was murdered. His parents still live in the same house. They just recently changed his bedroom.
They were moving the clothes out of the drawers and all of his things. That was hard.
People say life goes on, but for me, life stopped.
Barry says he can't help but feel like investigators gave up on BJ's case. A Jacksonville Sheriff's Office spokesman says sometimes time can be helpful because witnesses finally feel comfortable coming forward. This is Lindsay Kilbride in Jacksonville.
Florida's first bear hunt in decades starts next month. It's part of a plan to stop an increasing number of bears from coming into communities. But while Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission members are finalizing hunt details, Regan McCarthy reports the group is already looking for more solutions.
Florida Fish and Wildlife officials have never imagined that a bear hunt alone would solve the problem of bears and humans bumping into each other. But they do think it will help. Here's Thomas Eason speaking before the hunt received final approval. He's the FWC's Director of Habitat and Species Conservation.
We are serious about human safety. I can look at you and say 2 years ago, as the bear expert, I would have said there have been no serious bear attacks in Florida, and we're doing everything possible to prevent that. And the unfortunate reality is 4 serious attacks in the last, 14 months or so. And for us, that's a game changer because we can't ignore those dynamics. And the challenge is to find the right balance of, doing what's needed for human safety and also doing what's best for bears.
During a recent FWC commission meeting, officials finalized plans for the hunt. More than 1,800 bear hunting licenses have been approved, while officials have set a limit of only 320 bears that can be bagged. And Commissioner Ronald Bergen points out many of the bears that are killed in Florida this year won't die because of hunters. They'll be euthanized by the FWC.
If we're going to live with bears and have sustainable populations, it's a waste of the resource to euthanize bears and to put food out there to attract bears.
So far this year, wildlife officials have euthanized about 70 bears who have lost their fear of humans and begun to associate them with food. Last legislative session, lawmakers changed the state's no-feeding rules to create a stair-step penalty approach and make it easier to crack down on people feeding bears. But Eason says the food bears get from people's homes isn't always something that's intentionally been left out for them to eat.
The biggest one is garbage. We think it's gross. A bear is like an all-you-can-eat smorgasbord, and it is just a huge attractant to an animal that has evolved to fatten up to overwinter as many as 6 months up in northern climates.
90% of the bear-related calls the FWC receives come from just 14 counties in Florida. Eason says the solution is to get the people living there to use bear-proof trash cans. He estimates it'll take about 1.5 million cans to address the issue. But he says when it comes to getting people to use them, cost can be a barrier. So Eason has an idea.
A legislative budget request that would take revenues from our bear permits and then turn those back around into having cost sharing available so we can have somewhat of incentivized money coming from FWC to help with bear-resistant trash equipment as well as with the implementation and technical assistance.
Eason says something as simple as adding a latch to a can lead to a 50% reduction in bears snacking on neighborhood garbage. He says using a bear-proof trash can, which is much stronger, leads to a 95% reduction in complaint calls about bears. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
A Florida House Republican today proposed creation of a program that would offer financial help to dentists who practice in underserved areas. The bill filed by Representative Travis Cummings, Republican of Orange Park, will be considered during the 2016 legislative session and follows years of discussion about lack of dentists in some low-income parts of the state. Cummings's bill would lead to the creation of dental care access accounts, which would include state and local funds. Dentists who agree to practice in underserved areas could use money from the accounts for such expenses as repayment of dental school student loans and investment in dental office facilities and equipment. In the bill's words, the legislature recognizes that maintaining good oral health is integral to overall health status and that the good health of residents of this state is an important contributing factor in economic development. It goes on, better health, including better oral health, enables workers to be more productive, reduces the burden of health care costs, and improves the cognitive development of children. You're listening to Capital Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, earlier this year we shared a story about Jamal Davis and the Arts and Medicine program at Shands Health Center in Gainesville. Davis was waiting on a heart transplant, and he was passing the time singing with arts and medicine musician Ricky Kendall. Well, Davis got his new heart a few months back. Now that he's returned home, we wanted to check up on him. But first, we're going to play you the original story we aired back in May. Here's Nick Evans.
The University of Florida's Shands Hospital in Gainesville is a sprawling campus, straddling a state highway. There's a tunnel running underneath connecting two of the buildings. And up on the fifth floor, there's a guy named Jamal Davis, who loves to sing. The guitar player is Ricky Kendall. He's part of the hospital's arts and medicine program. Davis is the singer. He's smiling broadly, laid up in the hospital bed, surrounded by an array of monitors. There are tubes coming out of his arm. So, what's he doing here?
Wow, that's a long story. You got 7 years? No. I first was diagnosed with cardiomyopathy, just like an enlarged heart, pretty much. In 2008, during my senior year in high school.
After that diagnosis, he got a pacemaker and defibrillator, and that worked pretty well until 2012. He ended up back in the hospital, and this time doctors set him up with an LVAD, or left ventricular assist device, to help the struggling half of his heart. 6 months later, Davis was in Orlando, pursuing musical theater. But more recently, his condition started deteriorating.
I moved from Orlando February 1st to live with my parents. Then I was admitted into the hospital on March 6th, and I've been here ever since. So at the end of this month, it'll be 3 months, and I've been here waiting on a heart. So
about a month ago, some of the nurses sent word to the hospital's arts and medicine program that Davis really likes to sing. And that's where Kendall comes in.
I don't think you knew I was coming.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
And so you're kind of like, hey, okay, you have a guitar. All right. But what the nurse had told me before I walked in was, try to get him to sing. He can sing. He can really sing. And I said, okay, I'll try.
So Kendall played a few songs, and then he broached the question.
Would you want to sing something? And he kind of like was really reluctant for a few asks, and I was like, I pushed a little bit. I was like, oh, I heard you can sing. So he's like, well, do you know that song by John Mayer, Slow Dancing in a Burning Room? I was like, I think I actually do. So that's the first time we met. It's actually a little bit.
It's not a city little moment. It's not the storm before the calm. It's a deep and dying breath of this love that we've been working on.
Davis leans up and props himself on an elbow. As he starts singing, his eyelids drift down. And he holds his knee.
We're going down. Cause you know that we're doomed. My dear, we're slow dancing in the burning room. My dear, we're slow dancing in the burning room.
It wasn't the original key, I don't think.
Well, it worked. Jamal is an extraordinary example of how the arts can impact a patient's experience in this hospital, and I hope that's what the story becomes about.
Tina Mullen is the director of arts and medicine. She says the hospital experience takes control away from patients, separating them from most of their normal routine. But providing a creative outlet can help restore their sense of self, and this can lead to better clinical outcomes.
One of the things that we're very quick to say, though, in arts and medicine, is that art alone is not going to cure anyone. But art does heal somebody.
Singing is a big part of Davis's life, and he says the program makes handling the hospital just a little bit easier.
It's like really cool. I think it's really cool to like have an outlet musically to express yourself or just remove yourself from a situation that you really can't help or change. So I think that's pretty cool.
The other day, Davis and Kendall played a handful of Boys to Men songs. The nurses were at the door singing along. This is one of Kendall's own. It's called Open Arms. He and Davis haven't written any originals together yet, but they're working on it.
Overall, the wait was 8 years. I was in the hospital this past visit when I got my heart. I was there for 4 months.
This is Jamal Davis now. He's got a new heart, he's back at home in Ocala, and he's doing well. Earlier this week, we had a chance to touch base with him. Here's some of that interview. I guess, first off, how are you?
I'm really, really good, actually. I had a biopsy on Monday, and had a little bit of rejection issues, but nothing that's not normal within the first year of getting a transplant, so Everything's pretty much under control as far as my health goes.
Okay, so what's the nicest thing that you've been able to do since you've been, you know, out of the hospital bed? What did you miss the most that you're now able to do?
The first thing that I missed doing was actually taking a shower. I had an LVAD, my left ventricular assist device, which didn't allow me to take a regular shower. I have a shower bag that I have to wear all the time. And it's like getting in a shower with nothing connected to me and just going there, not worried about getting this wet, keep that dry, and just being able to enjoy a hot, steamy shower was really nice. But I got the chance to go to the beach, get in the water. So it was like the first time I've been in like water for 8 years. It was really nice to like be able to do that.
Wow. Okay. So now you love to sing, and that absolutely came across. So what are you doing right now, so far as music?
Right now, I'm working on doing a little EP, like mixtape thing. It's going to be generally speaking about my whole experience, you know, with the disease. Ricky Kendall, he's going to be helping me with the project, playing and helping write some of the music. So that's what I'm doing right now.
Davis says he wants to get back to work on his degree. He was studying music, performance, and business before heart disease took over. He says someday he might like to have his own small record label. Every other week, Davis is getting blood taken or biopsies done, but that'll tail off soon. He'll be on anti-rejection medication for the rest of his life, but Davis says it's a fair trade-off for a new heart. Once life returns to normalcy, Davis says he'd like to volunteer with Arts and Medicine. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.